All right, I'm going to go ahead and get started. It's a little after 5. I want to thank all of you for attending the second lecture of this year's Modern Graduate Series. My name is Erin Starr White, and I'm Assistant Curator of Education here at the Modern. A little bit about the series. It is designed to foster a vibrant creative dialogue among fine arts and art history graduate students from across the DFW Metroplex. By hosting artists, scholars, and critics with a Texas connection, we aim to expose area graduate students to a wealth of local and regional talent and expertise. And I hope that your participation in these evenings will serve as a catalyst for your personal and intellectual growth, and also to help connect you to the larger art scene that's happening in Texas right now. For this evening's lecture, speaker Robin O'Neill will present a discussion on her body of work from the start of her career to now. Robin attended high school in the Metroplex, which is excellent, studied at Texas A&M University Commerce in East Texas, and lives and works in Houston. Her work was included in the prestigious 2004 Whitney Biennial, and Robin has been the featured artist in several solo museum exhibitions. I'm just going to name a few so that it's not too long. These include a show of her most important works to date at the Des Moines Art Center in 2010, and a solo museum exhibition at the Contemporary Arts Museum in Houston, which then traveled across the country, literally from coast to coast. Robin's work has been included in group exhibitions at the Kemper Museum of Contemporary Art, the Museum of Contemporary Art Chicago, as well as our very own Dallas Museum of Art, just to name a few. She is the recipient of numerous grants and awards, including a Joan Mitchell Foundation grant in 2008 and the Huntington Prize in 2009. Her work is presented by Praz de la... De la Valade, thank you. That does not come out. Gallery in Paris and Berlin, Susan England Gallery in New York City, and Dun & Brown Contemporary in Dallas. Robin is currently working on the production of The Tower, an opera she wrote while at Werner Herzog's Rogue Film School in Los Angeles, where she was the only non-filmmaker accepted to participate. That's very exciting. She also received a grant from the Irish Film Board and just returned from Dublin, where she was working on her first film. And last but not least, you can find Robin's work in the recently published anthology, Texas Artists Today. Please join me in welcoming Robin O'Neill.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for being here. I also want to say a special hello to my family who's here, too. So that's those guys right there. Okay, so I want to start with, I'm not going to pretend like I invented or started the show Roseanne, but or had anything to do with John Goodman's career, but I wanted to start with an image of John Goodman as Dan Connor tonight to sort of introduce you all to the sort of man that you're going to see in a lot of my work that I'm about to show. I'm from the Midwest. I grew up in Omaha, Nebraska. The show Roseanne was in Chicago, but a very similar feel where I'm talking about what I consider very middle American in every way, and I mean that as a compliment, and where I felt most comfortable because I went to grad school only for a year. I'm a dropout in Chicago, and I went to UIC there. It's a great school, and I was doing really well. Had all A's, and I just felt so weirdly uncomfortable in my position as a graduate student that I had an instinct that I needed to leave and come back to Texas and just try to start making work outside of the school environment. And right around that time, I was also starting the body of work and the series of work I'm about to show you, which are it's a series of work about all of these little men in sweatsuits and Nike tennis shoes. And I was basically drawing them because I missed what I considered, quote, normal people. People I thought of like my dad and my brother and his friends. I mean, also my mom, but for some reason I chose men as my archetype for humanity. So, and I've never once drawn a woman. So, I mean, not since figure drawing in school or something. I have at times, but not in my work. So anyway, Moving on, that's sort of my background into where I started making this. So this is a very early piece. These are all like, you know, Strathmore notebook size, whatever size that is. Maybe I cut it down a little bit. This is, again, I wanted to draw these guys just doing leisurely things like running around. Oh, sorry about the little arrow there. Running around, skiing. They had boats. They were like speed boats. But then every once in a while, you can see I can't help myself. Even when I think I'm doing something that looks like they're having fun, there's some dead guy there. And so, I mean, I thought these were really goofy drawings at the time, but there was always something horrific happening. So here, in a really obvious way, almost like I'm setting stages, you know, this definitely looks like a stage set in a way, where I just populate a landscape, drop some bombs, and, you know, guys start dying. Some guys are running off the page. This guy is, so he reappears. They had names at this time. They don't anymore because I multiplied them by the thousands. But that guy's name is Runaway Lionel. I thought he looked like a Lionel. And he really is always leaving the scene. He's kind of like smart enough to know that they shouldn't be jogging when bombs are being dropped. Most of them aren't that smart, though. And that kind of began me starting these like negative or threatening environments around these guys. So things slowly started to get more serious than I was even ready for when I started this series. I just thought I was kind of drawing a tribute to normal guys, and then things got a lot more complicated. For instance, here, this is from a series I did called They Walk, Fall, Continue, and Die. This kind of marks the beginning of my obsession with death, this series does, but also in men's inability to know exactly what to do on the planet. So here you see like a natural growth of bushes, and then this guy is trying to put a tree branch in the ground. Like he thinks that that might grow something. So these attempts at doing these productive things, but also sort of like the folly of men. They're just constantly, these guys are never really doing anything very intelligent, to be honest with you. And they end up doing very destructive things as well. I just threw this in to show you that I switched from that notebook-sized work to very, very large, very suddenly when I had a residency at Art Pace in San Antonio, and so I was lucky enough, that was the first time I got to work in a proper studio, because I was working on a drafting table in the corner of my little apartment up until this moment when I was granted this room to work in for a while. So this was a drawing that I'd wanted to do and had it planned for several years and was just finally able to have the space. So here it is all nicely framed afterwards. You can see that I use the triptych formation like old altarpiece paintings, which are very influential to me. But this one I'm going to read the title to you just because I think it's important. Everything that stands will be at odds with its neighbor, and everything that falls will perish without grace. So it's a sort of damned if you do, damned if you don't thing. And I wrote that title. At the end of these massive pieces I make, I tend to work on the titles almost as seriously as I did the drawings. I take my time and almost kind of, this is my way of pretending like I'm a writer, which is something I wish that I were. But this is also based on Hieronymus Bosch's Garden of Earthly Delights. If you look at it in structure, you see the middle, there's like a circle of men. They're going in a counterclockwise circle around a dead, uprooted tree. Whereas in Bosch's Garden of Earthly Delights, there's a counterclockwise circle of people around a swimming hole with naked people frolicking. So this is me taking that, taking the sexuality and sort of fun away from it. And you just have a bunch of men in sweatsuits jogging by sometimes dead bodies and also encircling this this dead tree, this uprooted tree, actually. It's important that there's still that root structure because it's sort of a mystery as to how it would have gotten there. This also began, before I go too far ahead, this also was when I started to realize I wanted to continue to use these men that I drew, multiply them by a lot, and use them as my version of humanity. So I realized this was going to be an apocalyptic series and that there was going to be no hope for these men, and that's why there's no women. So I purposefully let there only be men of a certain age so that eventually they're bound to die off and this was going to, this world that I'm creating was going to go away. And I also did many things to kind of hint around at that. You know, there's always these looming skies, excuse me, that feel like this darkening lid, this presence of doom constantly. So, again, this is another close-up. So these are all close-ups from that big one that we were looking at. This is just a close-up of them sort of contemplating death and looking at, you can see here how I draw nature, non-man nature, very differently than I draw the humans. I draw these men in a purposefully awkward, uncomfortable style. You know, like the way they stand, I can show you guys really quick. You know, when you take figure drawing, people, you're supposed to like pose a person like this, you know, or like dynamic poses. But my guys are always like slightly leaning forward and sort of like awkwardly posing their arms. So that's all really purposeful, but you'll never see me do anything like that to a tree, to a bush, to a branch, to a deer, to, you know, I treat them naturalistically. So this is another way for me to say to you or any of my hopeful viewers, you know, animals get it a little more than we do. We humans aren't quite sure why we're here in the world that I created. Again, this is kind of just another example of this. Also, the animals, if they're not killed off by man, they're always leaving the scene. So again, they're the smart ones who are saying, you know, I'm getting out of here. This isn't looking good. Whereas the humans just keep working out for some reason, you know? Okay, this one's called As Ye the Sinister Creep and Feign, Those Once Held Become Those Now Slain. So this one kind of contains some of my most violent imagery. I decided to do compositionally a sort of really strange thing where behind that buffalo, again, this is another triptych, really set up like an altarpiece painting, because, you know, that's where they would put the altar, where that blank spot is, where the cliff is. But anyway, in one diagonal of this drawing, there's all bad things happening. And I mean, like, people torturing each other, people hanging. And then the other diagonal, there's all men hugging and communicating and doing beautiful, kind things to one another. And they all intersect somewhere behind this buffalo. And they're all in little vignetted sections back there. So within this one big drawing that seems to be just about this big buffalo, there are thousands of these little men enacting different scenes. And this, the way that something good is juxtaposed directly next to something bad is sort of relating to my anxiety about being a human, which has a lot to do with my inability to sort of accept that there are such various things happening from, even in the crowd right now, like from one mind to the next. But I always thought about it. When I lived in Chicago, as I referred to it earlier, I was very uncomfortable for a lot of reasons, not only because I was only around art people and not my family, and it was also I was living in this high rise, and I'm a person who needs a lot of space, and I was living in a little apartment, and I had to take an elevator and encounter all these people along the way just to get home into my little space, and it would drive me crazy, and I would become obsessed with thinking as I walked down this long corridor of doors that all looked the same, like, what are all the various things that are happening behind these doors? The way we humans live next to each other is just crazy to me. Like, behind one door, there could be, you know, two people falling in love for the first time. And then the next door, there could be someone plotting murder. And then the next door, there could be something as mundane as someone drawing a skull for a still life for their seventh grade drawing class or something. And that was just something that would fascinate me about being, and it always does, being in a city, you see it more. But even when I take my nightly walk in the kind of suburban neighborhood I live in now, I think the same thing. It's just, so that's why you'll see in so many of these drawings where I have hundreds of different things laid out. I love making those types of variants. Like, everything is really close to one another, and it also doesn't seem like anyone's noticing these bad things are happening around them. So you can kind of sense some of that. Like, there's a little wrestling going on down there, some more there. You can see some guys hugging over there. But really, this is just a close-up for you to see. And he's in this bittersweet stance, this buffalo, by the way, you know, and you can see his eyes, which are actually drawn just like my cat's eyes. I started to look at her. Her eyes always look sad to me. And that's actually her fur, too. I sort of make everything up. I don't, like, all the birds, people always talk about me as being this, like, landscape painter, drawer, and that I look at all the, and I do watch birds for real in life, but I never refer to real Nature, I always make up my own. So this is sort of a buffalo, but it's also kind of my cat when you when you look closely. None of my trees are real trees. They're all just completely made up trees too. So if people test me on my birds and trees, I sadly know none of those things. Another close up from that. So this is where I find them doing something more, I don't know, positive, even though it's not that positive, but they're just kind of seem to be communing with one another, whereas normally you really don't even see them. They don't even look to be talking or noticing they're around. Again, around a dead, uprooted tree. Here also is where you kind of start to see it almost looks cultish, their behavior. So, you know, you're confronted again with the fact that they're all wearing the exact same outfit. And when there's this many of them, that looks suspicious. Why would we all be wearing the same outfit? And then I realized later I kind of do like researching cults. And if you guys remember the Heaven's Gate cult, some of you might be too young to remember, but the Heaven's Gate cult outside of San Francisco, this is exactly what they wore. They were purple sweatsuits, and Nike shoes. And so when you see they all committed mass suicide, for those of you that don't know, because they thought it was the apocalypse, so they wanted to die before that happened. And so you'll see, and the cops put them, basically shrouded them, and they're laying there with their little Nike tennis shoes hanging out from the bottom in the news footage. It's really bizarre. And I didn't mean for my men to be dressed like that, but it makes so much sense that they would be. So that's one of those things that I think a lot of artists would rewrite history and say, yeah, these are based on Heaven's Gate cult. But they're completely not. It was an accident, but I think somewhere in my subconscious that happened. And then to switch gears from the negative, this is one of my sweeter drawings. This is called As Darkness Falls on This Heartless Land, My Brother Holds Tight My Feeble Hand. My brother is here tonight, by the way. This is more about family, love, and it seems like all I focus on is the negativity, but there are still some drawings where I focus only on connection, and this is one of those. Even within that, though, you can see that there's still no shelter. These men never thought to build a little hut or house. They never even, you never see them eating either, by the way. They're never doing any of these normal things that most civilizations have realized they need to do. My guys don't do that. But here, everyone is in an embrace. That middle circle that ended up accidentally looking like a heart, making it even, like almost grossly sweet, that's just a circle of men all in an embrace together. And then even the two trees in the background, the trees are slowly forming into an embrace there. That reminds me, I brought a clip, now that we're on a tree, if you guys don't mind watching this clip from Ingmar Bergman's The Virgin Spring. This is for one, it reminds me of the way my work looks, but there's also something in the attitude of what this character played by Max von Sydow does with this tree that I think really relates to my work. And this is after he had found out that his daughter was raped, and he doesn't really know how to handle life after that. So this is very short, by the way. So that's it. Really beautiful movie. If you haven't seen it, I would say to definitely check that out. But that sort of relates to my obsession with, I don't exactly know how to put it without talking about it for like 10 years with you all, and I'll bore you to death. But there's also a poet that I love named Robinson Jeffers, who has a series, a poetry book and one poem called Be Angry at the Sun. And in short, I think that clip and a lot of other things that I obsess about, both in literature, in film, in poetry, in art, have a lot to do with not just accepting how things are in nature and understanding that you can be angry about how things are. And in a way, Max von Sydow's character is taking it out on nature, so it's all kind of circular. But I just thought it was beautiful and kind of made sense with a lot of these images today. This one is about consequence. I had seen this one, not in person, unfortunately, but the Ghent altarpiece by Van Eyck. And I realized how I didn't realize how crazy some of those paintings were from around that time period, but how they have multiple horizon lines. And so I started to think about just how strange that would be if I started to develop many horizon lines, and that would give me a chance to do even more stories within one picture plane. So here you have two men and their dog, which their dog has gotten loose. Something's going on. They're fighting. Then there's a little hole that leads into the ground, and then you see this hell scene acted out underneath. This drawing's actually really small. This drawing, I haven't mentioned, a lot of those huge pieces, well, I don't know if it made sense that they're big, but these guys are all about 15 feet long by 7 feet tall. These are really, really big drawings. So this one is even like kind of miniaturized. So all of those tiny, those are hundreds of little guys in a war down there. But they're all about as big as like a piece of, maybe bigger than a cracked piece of pepper or something. They're really tiny. I only use a mechanical pencil, by the way, except for a few sad attempts to use those graphite sticks and stuff. So all of these, even those big ones, those big skies are all done with, well, actually this one right here. So just a 0.5 mechanical pencil. So in real life, if you see them, I hope so. My friend Matthew's here. He can tell you later. But it does make a difference. It seems like just something I might do just to be able to say I do it, but it's not why. It creates this very weird nervous mark that I can only do with a little tiny, tiny lead. So that's important. And it allows me to do this kind of detailed work that I've done in this small piece, too. This one is, as my heart quiets and my body dies, take me gently through your troubled sky. You can kind of see kind of like a comet or a rainbow at the top. I started to draw these rainbows that were actually erased into the sky, which I thought was like a really sad way to do a rainbow. We think of rainbow, we think of colors and something sort of glorious. And then I took that part away and just made it this really somber version of a rainbow. But also something that this drawing is about the death of my grandmother. So there's this dead owl on that tree stump, and there's a funeral procession, and all these thousands of guys all are carrying a flower up to this gravesite, which is in the center there. I don't think I have, for some reason, I'm sorry, I don't have a close-up of that, but and I had many times, you know, symbology is really important in my work, and I had throughout many of these drawings, almost all of them that you've seen of these big multi-paneled pieces, drawn these five owls that were normally dead, and they were representative of my family and those that I was most fearful of dying, because I was always the type of kid when growing up, a lot of people do this, but it's sort of an obsessive trait that some people have where I would, if my dad had to go out of town, I would not be able to sleep if I looked at the clock at a certain time, and I would just make it up randomly every night, like 10:05 meant he was going to die on the airplane ride home, but if it was 10:04, then he was going to be safe if that's when I looked at the clock, and all these things. I just feared these guys dying so much that it's become a huge part of my work, too. So these five owls represent those people, and my grandmother was one of them. So when she died, those owls have been separated. So the other four owls are up in that tree looking down onto the gravesite. So from then on, there was sort of a dissolve in that storyline. But those are sort of the personal things. This is a small crowd, so I can tell you guys. I don't always tell people that part, but that is something really minor that you would notice if you saw these pieces together, and you wouldn't necessarily know. But I try to make it almost clear enough to where people have guessed before what that is. So hopefully you can see those. There's no close-up of that. There is a close-up of the owl in a minute. Here's another one based on kind of the Ghent altarpiece, but this, again, my exploration of hell. So this is called Oh, How the Heartless Haunt Us All. And in my estimation, with working with all of these men and making them do all these bad things, the thing that they do that's the worst, in my opinion, is when they just don't pay attention to one another at all. I mean, I'd much rather someone punch me in the face than ignore me. So that comes through in this work very clearly. I mean, I'd rather get in a fight, right, than just be ignored and be a nobody in this world. So this is them all staring. They're like zombies. They're just staring straight ahead, not paying attention to anything. And as a result, you look down. Everything about this picture plane is leading your eye downwards. Up top, you see these birds of prey, and they're cartwheeling. I don't know if anyone else is a bird watcher, but when birds of prey do, sometimes the way they mate is they connect in really high in the air, and then they they twirl downward, and they do it really fast. So while they're mating, they do what's called cartwheeling, and they just go like this, and they spin really fast. But the thing that happens sometimes is that they don't separate in time to do this, and they do like a duo suicide together accidentally while they're mating, which I always found to be really poetic and really beautiful. So that's what those are doing there. And then you've got this other triangle of guys, and you've got this dead tree leading downward. And then really this piece almost got banned from my last show because it's really that vicious. And I'm embarrassed to say the things that are happening down there. Also, the piece I'm working on right now in my studio is a huge version of hell, which makes that piece look tame. So I wish I had images of that, but it's secret right now. But I wish you guys could see it. But then you wouldn't want to talk to me afterwards. It's probably a good thing that I didn't bring it. This one is called Being Together. So another one that's, you know, there's two men up on that cliff together, sort of like the buffalo on that cliff. It's sort of bittersweet. I mean, it looks kind of idyllic, and they seem to be in a loving relationship of some kind, and yet when you really look at it, there is nothing happening for the, I mean, unless some mystery helicopter comes, these guys are doomed. In my opinion, this was their sort of like last hurrah. I also want to point out, you noticed before, there's all these mountainscapes and very sort of romantic landscapes. This sort of begins the flattening of the horizon line. You'll see it's so flat that it almost looks like I'm working with abstraction, which I think that I am in a lot of ways. I mean, basically, you turn that ocean upward, like if you were to flip that ocean part up, it's drawn exactly like that cliff is. So this is something that I do that, you know, I kind of was trained as a painter my whole life, and up until grad school, always made paintings and really loved abstract work. So I noticed slowly as this series, I mean, this thing took about 9 years for me to complete that we're looking at, I noticed me sort of veering back towards abstraction in a lot of different ways. This one is called Standing Below This Eternal Covenant, just a man discovering this dead horse. And I wanted to read from Cormac McCarthy, is a writer I really love. I don't know who of you have read The Road. The Road is something that mimics a lot about my work. But this, horses, there's a lot of dead horses in my work, and I hadn't read all the Pretty Horses, but this is just a small, and I don't love it, by the way. I don't love that book as a whole, but I do love this one excerpt. And I think it says a lot about animals and humans and the way that I see them. Lastly, he said that he had seen the souls of horses and that it was a terrible thing to see. He said that it could be seen under certain circumstances attending the death of a horse, because the horse shares a common soul, and its separate life only forms it out of all horses and makes it mortal. He said that if a person understood the soul of the horse, then he would understand all horses that ever were. Finally, he said that among men there was no such communion as among horses, and the notion that men could be understood at all was probably an illusion. So I'll leave it to him to say it. I just said it. I won't expound. This is me taking that dead owl that was based on my grandmother and blowing it up really big. So this piece is about, I think, about 6 feet by 6 feet, and it's just called The Passing. So you can see up close like a soul leaving this owl's body and its eyes opening up. This is just to get, I don't know why I threw this in, I guess. This is my studio, actually. I live in the suburbs. I work in a carpeted spare bedroom. It's very unglamorous, but it's exactly how I need things to be for some reason. So I work in a way that's kind of very atypical to most artists that I know. And I work with the TV on all the time, by the way. I mean, I just work like I'm hanging out, but it's just me in the studio for hours a day. I don't know why it looks so dark there. It's normally, although, yeah, I do. I block out my lights, too, now that I think about it. I hate natural light in my studio, which is also not common. I mean, normally you want that. Although, Matthew, you do that sometimes, don't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, you do. You're the only other one I know. Okay, so that was me working on this huge piece. This is my largest piece to date. It's called Masses and Masses Rove a Darkened Pool. Never is there laughter on the ship of fools. This was based on, I had read the medieval allegory about the ship of fools, which, you know, Hieronymus Bosch did a painting of. Catherine Porter wrote a book called Ship of Fools. I think it's just called Ship of Fools. But, you know, poets have referred to the Ship of Fools. If you don't know it, back in medieval times, it's said that when someone was deemed insane, people would send them off on these, like, man-made rafts into the ocean to die. So they thought that was better use of an insane person, to just throw them out into the ocean. And so I decided that it was coming to a close. I could feel this series after about 8 years. I was ready for these guys to die, basically. I mean, I was, you know, you feel these things as an artist. You know when you're over certain things. I was ready to see this world crumble. I didn't ever know how I was going to do it. This is like a launching off pad for how these guys could start to dwindle off in a major way. So here we've got just tons of man-made rafts. I've got a close-up, I think. Yeah. So all these little man-made rafts, the first man-made thing that they've ever done, they've never created a thing in all of these years, but they finally figured out how to do this. So we can imagine that maybe a tsunami came. We don't know, but the world's pretty much gone now, and they have ocean only. And here they're clamoring to survive. So you see some of them taking leadership roles, like that guy standing up. Other people are just, you know, falling into the ocean on purpose. And then I just wanted to show this because really the sky is almost like a big version of the way I draw the waves. So again, there's something really abstract about this whole thing when you look at it. If you blur your eyes, this is an abstract drawing. But then when you look close, there's all this stuff happening. I also love that the sky, when I flatten that horizon and did these skies the way that I do them now, it was almost like the sky is just eating up the entire world. So it seems to be devouring all of these humans. This is just a little, another kind of piece about the ocean taking over. This is called The Ruin. This I made, you know, living in Houston, dealing with all the hurricanes we had dealt with around the time. This seems like a surreal image to see this branch floating above the ocean, but as a lot of us know, you know, you heard me say I'm from Nebraska, so I grew up in Tornado Alley because I also lived up here. So we've all probably, most of you here have lived through a tornado or two if you've lived here for a long enough time. And so, and especially during those hurricanes in the last, you know, 5 years, you just can't look at the world the same. None of this doesn't look surreal to me. Like, I really saw things floating, like flying through the air like this on that day. So that's kind of what that is. And also just a mysterious drawing. I actually hate to talk about these more mysterious ones too much because I think they just kind of, they're a little quieter than my other work and not as talk-based, which is good for me. Here's just another piece of bird finding, you know, this bird is a monogamous bird. According to me, again, this is a made-up bird, so I don't know, but you know how some birds are monogamous, and I've experienced some of the birds in my yard looking for their partner, and the other one, then I find the other one dead, so that's a piece kind of based on real experience. This kind of begins while I was closing up that work. I was also working on these other images that were sort of more poetic and very unclear compared to my other work. So this is called A Disharmony, and it's basically the beginning of me just sort of, well, and really that branch piece as well. These are just disturbed worlds. Like something is just slightly wrong and you're not even sure why or what's happening. So I started to like there to not be as many explanations, and that's when you see these, that's what they are. And this one was sort of, this is another 14 feet by 7 foot one. It's sort of a foreshadowing of what could come. I think of narrative work as sort of labyrinthine. So you can imagine an artist maybe coming back to a story they thought was over, you know, 30 years from now. Here, there's all these little guys falling from that island in the sky. So this is me sort of jumping off of that double horizon line thing. And then also, there was this amazing story. You guys have probably seen the movie Magnolia by Paul Thomas Anderson, but really, you know how all the frogs fall in the end? Well, that's really based on this old story of Magonia, which was I think in the 1400s in the countryside in France somewhere, all these people showed up. It was basically a cult. But they claimed that they fell from a ship that circumnavigated the clouds and that they were put on Earth to do something. And so they had this crazy story that they fell from the sky, basically. And that has spawned a lot of different stories. like the film I mentioned, but it also, to me, you know, there's actual these natural phenomena all over the world. You know, not that long ago in Austin, all these birds that aren't, they're not supposed to be in Austin, fell from the sky and landed on this, like, this area about 5 blocks wide in downtown Austin. Sometimes people will find, like, pieces of sand falling from the sky. So something's going on in the world where this actually does happen sometimes. I'm sure people don't fall from the sky, by the way. I don't believe in that, although I'm recreating it and jumping off of that story and hoping this might plant the seed for some other narration far, far from now. I'm not ready for it, right? I'm not ready to deal with these guys again right now, but maybe someday. And this is how I put this series to rest. This is called These Final Hours, Embrace at Last. This is our ending. This is our past. Just a monstrous ocean, a threatening sky, and one man hanging by a fraying rope above it all. So, you know, it's funny to talk to people when they're in front of this piece because I would say, you know, it's so obvious to me, like, that this guy's going to die and it's all over. But you would be surprised. I would say, honestly, more than half, like, probably 60% of people, because I think people at the... Just, I don't know, I think people are more hopeful than I am or something, because people really love to think that this guy is crawling up into heaven. So I do think that there's a reason I situated this composition this way. He is not dying. He is not falling from the rope. I did want it to be unclear, and I did want it to look, I mean, where is that rope coming from, first of all? He truly could be climbing up to somewhere else. So I do love that, but... it's funny, there was this nice elderly woman at my show when this was first shown, and she was very upset and actually wondered if my parents were around to make sure I was okay, because the show was very dark and she was worried about me, and she asked me directly if he was going to be okay, and I said, I have to be honest with you, no, I mean, this is like the end of my series. And she goes, well, I don't believe you. I think he's crawling right up to heaven. So she refused, and I said, that's fine. We'll see. Maybe she's right. So that pretty much is the end of that series, and that was about 2 years ago, I'd say, so maybe a little longer. So I just wanted to end with a few kind of to show you where my work is, but it's not really here anymore either. So I was in a very unsure place. I think it's very good to talk, especially to students, about the fact that, you know, none of us are ever going to have it solved. And I certainly didn't. I mean, I did basically, you know, career suicide by ending the thing that made my career happen. And that it hasn't been good for me as an artist career-wise, but I really could care less because I'm here to do other things, not just like be an artist in a career situation. So I had the need to make other work. This is called The Dismantled. So I just drew the ship upside down, sort of vignetted it. I sort of think a lot of these that are really more simple. These are about 6 feet by 6 feet around there. I kind of think those big pieces were like my novels, and then I sort of made some smaller ones that could be like full chapters or something, and this was my chance to like make poems or even, not even a poem, I think these are fragments of poems. This one's called The Awakening, and in a way, since I, even though I upped my scale so big, I guess I never mentioned, you know, the men never got bigger than about this. They're really, really tiny. So to have a head about this big all of a sudden is a huge switch for me, even though it's the back. That's called Reconfigure. If you guys are interested, you know, Caspar David Friedrich, the German romantic, a lot, from behind, so it's, Reconfigure means that in German, which is a more contemplative stance. This also, I think, was the turning point for me to start thinking about humanity as maybe not so bad, and these guys, someone might be taking a leadership role, and so we as the viewer are kind of following him into this, like, vast nothingness in this piece, but he's also, like, got better hair. I mean, there's, like, subtle differences where he's a little more sophisticated than those guys that I had been dealing with for so long. So, and then I'm just going to end on this, which really is, like, me accepting abstraction in a way. I see it as an upside-down hurricane wave. You can see it as a million other things, but it's just, you know, me playing with those waves, and again, to imagine the world upside down. Things have already been sort of I don't know, dismantled and shaken up in so many ways with my world that it's kind of completely crumbled. I am back to making, you know, drawings with normal horizon lines and all these different things happening, just with a whole other cast of characters, and they don't look really like this, but they're sort of back to that. So it's interesting how these things shift and fall away, and you get really sick of yourself all the time, and then you miss certain things you've been drawing. So I missed figuration is what I'm saying. I think this is the first time I've said it out loud. Now that I have a microphone, it feels even better, and I like to be loud. So I thought I was done making human beings all together, and I was so ready to not look, never make one again. And then, I don't know, not even that long ago, I would say just maybe 4 months ago, 3 months ago, it just became clear that I couldn't tell the stories I wanted to tell with my work without human life being in there. So that's what I'm currently working on, one with even more than any of those could ever dream of having. Like, then they're tinier and they're collaged. So they really are the size of cracked paper, but they're little collaged, robed figures. So I wish I had examples, but stay tuned. They'll be shown somewhere one day, I hope. But that's pretty much it for the images. So we can open up. I don't know if you guys want to turn the lights on and open it. I know we can talk again. We're going to go for drinks and stuff, but in here is a good place to also ask for questions. I can go back to any images and stuff. Matthew.
Do these drawings develop? I mean, I know that they develop over a great deal of time, but do they, I mean, you have this sort of massive story that you're going to tell in a particular work. Do they change drastically during the making of the work, or are they pretty much planned and play out?
Yeah, you mean on an individual basis, does one ever alter conceptually in a drastic way, or?
Right, like how you lay out the composition and
yeah.
The story changes as you start developing.
Okay, yeah, no, that's a good question. They don't change very much. I mean, truthfully, I do thumbnail sketches that I can show you guys an example of. Okay, like that guy, here, I just found the thumbnail for this. So something this big, but this was true of the other work too. You guys, even in the back, can see how small this really is. So this little guy became that drawing, which was another big drawing. But even those massive ones with tons of activity really do start as the tiniest thumbnail. And I'll pick that up later. Oh, that's just my ticket. Don't even. So on something more complicated though, like let's go back. I don't know how to describe it. It's very basic, and no, they don't change. So I will know on the thumbnail, like basically I'll just draw where the horizon line is. I'll draw where the main activity is. So I'll know that this is where the funeral needs to happen. I know there needs to be a tree trunk here with the owl there. And then I'll sketch it in on the big one, just very, very loose, like barely there lines. And then, weirdly, Matthew, I work left to right and up to down, so I work in like a strata formation without the humans first. So I really will set the stage. I will just do the backdrop, basically. So I'll work on the sky, then I'll work on the snow and the trees. And it's pretty much set in stone how it goes. I mean, aside from when there's hundreds of men, I get to have like a little bit of fun in improvisation, I guess, by like, you know, making one guy trip and fall when I didn't know he would do that. But basically, I know they're all really choreographed the way the men are. So I mean, those look like abstract lines too. So I knew there'd be these lines. Within there, I can have two talking to each other, but so after I set the stage, then the men come, and I don't change very much. I mean, the way I draw, like, these little fern-type things take so long that within there, I don't know exactly how one will fall, necessarily. I know there will be a bunch of them falling like this, but then I do these delicate little things that are my way of sort of, you know, I don't know, not getting bored, but because it doesn't make me bored to sit in front of these for as long as I do, but, you know, so these, yeah, but I have to say, no, nothing really changes. It's pretty much set out, and I carry it through. And these, you guys take, these big ones took me, I don't, around like 7-8 months, right around there. And I don't work on anything else when I'm working on the big ones. I just work on these. And they do take that long, mainly because of this attachment to my pencil. Oh, the other thing I use to make the skies look the way they do, you guys know those, well, I call them smudge stumps, but whatever those are called. Smudging stumps, blending tools, tortillons, what are they called? My mom gave me one when I was in seventh grade, a big one that I had a lot of them, but this one that she gave me has ended up being, you know, like my best friend, and it's been, I use it on every drawing I've ever made because it has this patina, you know, I'm 33 now, so however old someone is in seventh grade until now, I've used this thing. I have to put a piece of glassine over it because my hand, you know, has made it all messed up, but it has a patina of, you know, I don't know, 20 years of me working with it or whatever, in graphite. So, and also I don't touch my paper when I'm working on any of these to further the exploration of how I make these is I always, my hands are really gross and sweaty all the time. So I always have to put a piece of glassine under my hand when I'm working. So my hand really never touch my paper. So it's like as pristine as you can imagine. Actually, it's funny. I keep referring to Matthew, but he's the only person who's more pristine than I am with our paper. And that's hard to come by, but he beats me out. So, any other questions while we're in here? Yeah.
You had mentioned that you're influenced by literature and poems. Are there any artists that you, maybe contemporary artists that you look to for, you know, inspiration or?
No, I really don't like artists. No, I do like a lot of artists. Contemporary artists, the more obvious jump would be William Kentridge, but I really didn't like his work until maybe 3 years ago, embarrassingly. I don't know why. So I can't list him as an influence. The contemporary artists I love the most offhand are, I love Alex Katz, which I don't think you can see in my work at all. For some reason, he's one of my favorites, though. Who else do I love? I mean, I look back to the old masters a lot more, admittedly, but I love Robert Longo, which people can see in my work in a very weird way. And I especially love Robert Longo's kind of newer pieces of explosions and stuff. Some of Vernon's pieces are really influential to me, too. I realize even more getting to see the Vernon Fisher show today. I don't know why I can't think of very many living artists right now. I mean, I'm always devouring as many as I can and buying way too many books of contemporary artists, so it's a good question. I'll keep thinking about it. I don't know why no one's coming to mind, though. That's sad. I'll think about it.
I wonder, in reviews of your work, if there are any surprising interpretations, different interpretations than what you intend, or I'm especially interested if there are some ideas about why you're using men that are surprising to you or make you rethink.
Well, I mean, normally it's rare that something is really off from the way I see it. There are things that'll surprise me that people can come to and understand that I never guessed, that I thought was very subtle and that no one would ever see in my work that I thought was really personal. Like my Catholic background is something that I never really, I don't think I refer to it in a very direct way. But those that know Catholicism well immediately based on my work, I am pinpointed as a Catholic in a very direct and easy way for people who know that religion very well. So I find that interesting, and that was surprising to me at first, but then once I realized how often that was happening, it's now I'm used to it and I see it more, and I've actually worked with that a lot more and been more kind of admitted how much that's a force in my life. I don't consider myself Catholic now, but it's something that is still very dear to me and a huge part of how I saw things growing up. So there's that. And about the men, I mean, every once in a while someone, it's never written about, but someone will want, they'll either think I'm a man hater or I don't appreciate women so much. So every once in a while someone will be like, why are you leaving women out? They're the biggest force. Sometimes people see nature as the feminine force in my work, which I can actually see a little bit more if there is to be one. I don't think that there needs to be that balance, but people will see that happening. And every once in a while people will be, you know, wondering why I couldn't just kill off everyone. Like, why couldn't there have still been men and women and procreation and children and then I could still kill them off. That could would have been possible, right? It was a natural disaster anyway. That I really can't answer. It's definitely not a man-hating thing. It just seemed that to put one female in my work makes it an entire different read. I was never interested in talking about direct sexuality, and even though every once in a while I was very obviously having some of these men fall in love with each other, I just didn't want to talk about sexuality that much, never really was interested in it, and so that's another reason I left it out. It's definitely the weirdest part about my work, that there's only men. And I think that there is a lot of unanswered questions about that for people who know my work well, for people who are new to it, and even for me. I think it's weird that I'm that resistant to dealing with females in my work. I mean, I grew up around mainly men. My mom and I are best friends, but aside from that, you can ask any of my friends, I don't have female friends. I just was around almost all men my whole life. So it's also kind of based on that. It's where I feel comfortable. Which is sad, but just the truth, you know? It's just who I am. But, you know, who knows what'll happen next? These new figures are completely obscured, where you can only tell they're human. I don't know if they're women or not yet, to be honest with you, so there could be.
In the one of the triptychs, I think, back where the really bad stuff was going on and the really good stuff was going on.
Yeah, this one?
I might be wrong then.
It's okay.
It might be. There's a tree in the center that's kind of half in one of the pine trees.
This one, maybe.
Yeah, it's yeah,
no.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Yeah, it's like fully realized at the base, and then at the top it just kind of peters out.
Oh, yeah, there's pine needles at the bottom, you mean, and then none? Maybe here. Is that it? No? Maybe. I think that's the end of the big one, so. But that makes sense. I know what you're talking about, where it's like alive at the bottom and dead at the top.
All the other trees around are very alive. And I think that was it, that you just, yeah, there you go. That's the one down the bottom.
Oh, there, in the middle, yeah.
You've got a couple other dead, deadish one over to the right.
Yeah. Yeah, and that would be referring back to when I'm playing around and, you know, like one of these trees, like one of the ones in the foreground are only about that big, but the way that I draw these trees, I remember this, I was on a tight schedule because I only had 3 months to make this one. So one of these trees takes about 8 hours to make. And so there is something that happens to you when you are drawing that tiny for that long, where you need to invigorate yourself by doing something a little more interesting. And also, that's my way of kind of having fun. It's like, okay, now I'm going to draw a tree that looks like that, but a little bit different. I mean, they're very minor little characteristics that I change. They look like they're just dying off and not as full as the others, which, you know, I can't stop myself from making so much that I do about death. It's just, you know, something I care deeply about pursuing in my work. So I think that's basically it. And also, just to add a little interest, like some, you know, a lot of my decisions are purely formal, to be very frank with you. I mean, it comes from a need for something to look a certain way and to make that area of the drawing a little less full or less heavy or dark. So sometimes those things will happen for that very reason. Like the reason that there's a really tall, dead tree without pine needles up there, I can't imagine a big, heavy tree like this being there, just basically because of, you know, it would interrupt that whole circle of men, you know? So a lot of times it really is just, some people are sometimes embarrassed to say that it's for formal concerns, but a lot of my work is so much about the formal qualities that I always kind of embrace it, you know?
I love the scale of your skies, too. It seems like it's influenced by living in Texas, possibly.
Oh, I think so. Yeah, anywhere I travel, you cannot get more beautiful, huge skies than we have here. And it is, and I'm a weather watcher. I'm not as much anymore. I don't have time. But in college, I would take the highs and lows every day and send them into the meteorologist at Channel 11 and all this. So, I mean, I am obsessed with weather. It's one of my biggest interests. And you'll also notice that the sky, the horizon lines were always really high up. And as time went on and the years went on and these guys were dwindling off, the horizon line started to get really low to the ground as well. So I was, you know, the sky became bigger, the earth became smaller. Basically, like, the sky, everything above was sort of winning and killing everything below in a way.
Part of the triptych, is that like a leg? You know, like your fallen man? Is there, it kind of, so I was looking at the mountains and it kind of looks
I don't see that, no. But, you know, I will say that there's all sorts of things in these mountains, because this is before, I feel like I was really drawing mountains just in an awful way. Like, I just didn't know how to draw mountains or something. I don't know. So they look very weird and unfinished. And you look at these mountains compared to the way my mountains look. Let's see if I have any other mountains. You can't even really see because they're smaller, but I just kind of got better at drawing mountains and cliffs. So there they looked almost cartoon-like. So you, yeah, they were really harsh. And also, that's true of all my work. Like, things were really black and white and not as much of that middle. And then things got, I think, a little bit softer as things went on, too. So then those kind of things you couldn't pick out. But no, there wasn't a leg there, although I know what you're talking about. It looks kind of weird. Yeah.
You showed us with the guy's legs sticking out.
I know. It does. Yeah, you're right. I totally see that now. But it is unintentional, I hate to say.
Terry?
I'm not even sure how to form this question, but I'm so interested in going back to Matthew's question and your response about that, you know, not much changes once you begin a drawing. But I'm very curious, because now you're talking about your process, and you don't know if these figures are female or male, and there's a lot of unknown that you seem to be kind of working your way into understanding.
Yeah.
So was there a point with this work that you didn't know where they were going either, and they only seem so premeditated and such because you're looking back on it?
Yeah, oh, basically, I think you're asking, like, in the moment, even maybe in the midst of making one of these large ones, I don't exactly know how to interpret it. Is that what you're kind of, like, I don't really know what it means for the full story sometimes. Is that what you're kind of getting at?
And even like for your large, you know, your larger body of work, maybe what role these men play. At some point in the early work, did you not understand those men? And then as you worked with them, you began to understand them better? Or?
Yes. I think that you're getting to something really important, and you actually did a better job articulating it than me. But I think basically what you're asking is, I mean, basically my response to what you're saying is, that, well, first of all, yes, I am very unclear about the broader scope of what this body of work necessarily means. What these men mean at a given moment changes for me. I think it's also incredibly complicated for me that they came out of a love for my dad and his friends and normal guys, and then yet I, you know, totally opposed from my love of them, they became something else that I wanted to kill. And that's not what I wanted to do to my dad. And so I realized, oh, these men mean something totally else to me than I originally thought. Because clearly I did think in the beginning that I was just drawing the guys I love the most in the world. Then I started to do these sinister things or make them do sinister things. And I realized this is happening without me realizing it kind of thing, which happens when you make narrative work, I think, to a lot of us, especially ones with this many stories within one piece a lot of times. And I think I had so much I wanted to tell. I do remember early on when I was first making my first big piece, I said to myself, oh, like once I started to multiply them by hundreds and thousands, I thought, I could do this until the day I die. I could tell every story I've ever wanted to tell with these men. I could get away with that in my head. Like, this is my outlet for all the stories I want to talk about. And it felt really good and really big. Because when you come across something like that as an artist, I think all of us know, that's very good feeling, you know? But then things changed. And then guess what? It turned out I couldn't tell all the story. That's why things dissolved and why you see branches floating over the ocean. I never would have imagined that being a part of my work when I had this like big moment of clarity. So I'm always, and I think, you know, now that these men are put to rest, I still have questions about exactly what they are. And I have definitely have what I know they are men, but the new ones are the ones that I don't know if they're female. And so those, I hope that I'll continue to have those questions about these new figures for a long time, because I think that, I think it's good for me. I think it's, and it also opens the work up to, you know, broader concepts for me and then broader interpretations for viewers. So, yeah, I mean, I think as, that's a good point, Terry, is as close to the plan as these drawings are, there's still so many unknowns for me, you know, and I think for everyone. There's a million questions being asked in a lot of these, but yeah. The men and my idea of them fluctuate.
Maybe another way to ask this more simplistically, too, is you got to it with that. That was a very good response. I understand what you're saying, but do you, in this maybe way too simplistic, but do you see yourself more as a director, as an artist, or a conduit?
A director, for sure. Like, I don't even have to think about it too long. I don't know how to answer it other than saying I definitely feel like, you know, the god of this world, and I love making these decisions, and I know even though it does come from places in my brain that are a little dreamy and not totally solid and understood by me, I still think that the gist of it is very directed and very clear to me, you know? I mean, I think I could go into the subtleties forever and question the subtleties, but I think overall it still is an apocalyptic story about men who did bad things and made the world end because of it. So I think like that I always knew. So that I directed. So I would say like the big stories I don't have any questions about. But I think there's enough stuff happening that I can question for a really long time. But it is true. I hope that, yeah, so that's a good conduit or director. Those are good, a good dichotomy to think about. But yeah, I mean, and also you got me thinking, I don't know how many of you this is true for, but it is funny how much comes to light once a drawing's put away, and they become much clearer for a long time afterwards. Looking at them today, it's very clear. I mean, I'm very aggravated with a lot of these early ones. I don't even like looking at them. But also, I understand them better now. I think I get them. When I'm making them, I'm like, oh, got this one solved. I know what this one's about. I'm going to write some notes about it in my little composition book. I know how to talk about it in my gallery talk. I don't know any of it at that point, but I think I do, and then I really do later on, I think. That's true of a lot of people, I think. Like, just like the Heaven's Gate thing, that's so ridiculous. That I was more of a conduit with, because I think they look so much like the Heaven's Gate cult. But I really didn't mean to do that.
A type.
Yeah.
Inevitably in life, that type was going to manifest itself or something.
That's true. That makes sense. Any other questions? Yes.
Could you talk a little bit about your titles? You say you spent a lot of time on it, and at what point that happens, and are they from your composition book? Where does that happen?
Yeah, good question. Yeah, they all are. I've had the same composition notebook, and they discontinued this thing, by the way, so I'm very angry right now. If anyone sees any that look just like this, buy them, and I'll pay you a lot of money for them. Anyway, so I have, like, you know, hundreds of these that I've been working with for a long time. But at the end, after the work is done, I've worked so long on these that I love this opportunity to sit down in my studio in my comfortable chair. It's an old living room chair from my parents, by the way. It's ugly, by the way, but I still love it. So I sit there, and I look at the drawing, and I think about it, and it always starts with something really basic. Like, this drawing would be Circle of Men or something stupid like that. And then I'll slowly think about it. The big ones get the long titles, because I think they kind of deserve it. They take that long to make, and I usually have a need to make them be longer titles, so... And then I'll just slowly form it, and I'll write that at the top of one of these pages, and then, so Circle of Men, and then it'll have a fancier version of Circle of Men with Fallen Tree or something. And then slowly but surely it comes together.